Well, 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 looky here. It's time to fry some fish, huh? Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 457 of this here electronic engineering podcast called Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry. Brought to you by EEJournal.com and written, produced, and hosted by yours truly, Amelia Dalton. Are you ready for a deep dive into the world of machine programming? I certainly hope so. I'm super excited to welcome Justin Gotchlik, Principal AI Scientist and Director/Founder of Machine Programming Research at Intel Labs. Justin and I are talking about how we can increase engineering productivity by 1,000% and create superhuman code with the help from machine programming. We take a closer look at the motivation behind the development of this pioneering research initiative, the details of Intel's open-source machine programming research system called Control Flag, and why Justin believes that automated debugging and performance extraction, and why Justin believes that automated debugging and performance extraction will unlock untold possibilities in the realm of software and hardware development. Hi, Justin. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Amelia. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. I'm really excited to talk with you today.
Excellent. Now we're talking about machine programming today, but first, for my audience who may not know, explain to me what machine programming is all about within Intel Labs, and how did you get started in this arena in particular?
Oh, these are great questions. For the first part, for Intel, machine programming at Intel is doing a number of things for us. The overarching drive of the field is essentially around the automation of the development of software, and as a byproduct, the automation of the development of hardware. And the reason why it works that way is if you look at how hardware is developed today, much of hardware development is actually done through software. So if we can automate the software, the byproduct then is that we actually get the benefit of automating the hardware as well. And Intel is using machine programming in a bunch of different ways. We are sort of focusing on two core tenets with the machine programming research group that I oversee. And those two tenets are improvement in developer productivity. It's a very audacious goal to improve programmer productivity by more than 1,000x. And to sort of quantify this in a concrete example, what might take 3 years to do today, we want to be able to do in one day in the future with machine programming. So very audacious. And we don't expect to achieve this in the next 6 months or anything. And it'll probably take us several decades. But Intel really thinks that machine programming is the future, which is why we are a pioneering research initiative, which essentially says, okay, this is something that we should invest in, and it's likely to take several decades. But along the way, we can be making incremental steps forward in this space that then we can leverage. So that's one tenet, the temporal aspect, improving developer productivity. The second tenet is, as we're automating the development of software, we want to ensure that the quality characteristics that are associated with that software that we're synthesizing are at least as good as the best human programmers in the world. Essentially, we want to have them be superhuman, superhuman code that's generated. So these two ideas, we've got 1,000x improvement in productivity on one hand, and then superhuman code that we're generating. And usually when I tell people this for the first time, they kind of look at me like I'm completely insane. And that, okay, your talk's over. This podcast interview has ended. But then I raised with them one very simple example. And that example is Adobe Photoshop version 21. And something miraculous has happened in Adobe Photoshop version 21 that not many people know about. And that is, there are two critical pieces of machine programming that my colleagues in academia have created. One is a technique called verified lifting. It's being led by Professor Alvin Chung at University of California, Berkeley. The other piece is halide. And that is work that's being led by Jonathan Reagan Kelly out of MIT. What they were able to do with these two pieces of technology, verified lifting and halide, is this process known as transpilation. Transpilation is the idea that you take code from one programming language and then you automatically convert it to semantically equivalent code in another programming language. Now, this is a very hard process, and there are lots of complications on how to do this. With these two techniques, they have been able to do this in one specialized area for Adobe Photoshop, essentially taking C and C++ code, lifting out the semantics, formally verifying the semantics are lifted properly, and then lowering to halide, and then halide runs essentially the stochastic system that does automatic performance tuning. But the end result is they did this process on Adobe Photoshop code automatically. It transpiled roughly 300 functions in approximately 200 hours. And the resulting code that was generated had a geometric mean speedup of more than 3.3x, which essentially means it's over 200% faster than the original code. So if we look at this now from those two tenets of 1,000x improvement in productivity and superhuman code, we actually now have one concrete example that exists today and is in production quality code that's out there deployed in the world. Not many people know about this. So this is usually the canonical example that I say, okay, so before you tell me I'm crazy, let me share the story. Now, as a scientist, I want to be super clear that the verified lifting halide example in Adobe Photoshop is specialized. One of the core challenges is now how do we take this concept and generalize it? And I think we're very far away from that. So I don't want to try to mislead anyone or overstate claims on where we are in the field. There's a ton of work to do, but at least now we have one concrete empirical data point that says, no, actually, you can achieve this. So that's basically a background about machine programming and what we're doing with Intel and a lot of our academic collaborators. And as far as how I got interested in machine programming, I was actually always in love with machine learning. I think I took my first machine learning class when I was a master's student at University of Colorado Boulder. I took the general artificial intelligence class, which I liked, but it was not very deep. Just sort of quickly move from topic to topic, which was exciting, but I'm sort of a depth person. So then I took a specialized course called Neural Architectural Design, and it was all about learning about neural networks. And I became just stunned with this neural network thing. I thought, wow, this is amazing. The machine essentially learns the algorithm. So I don't code the algorithm, the machine learns the algorithm. And I thought, oh, this has so much potential. And I remember going to my advisor saying, I want to switch. I was on the track to do parallel computing. And I want to switch to machine learning now. I want to do neural stuff. And this is back in 2004, way before the machine learning boom, right? This is the AI winner, right? And he says to me, no way, absolutely not. First of all, neural networks, they're not going anywhere. And second of all, the theoreticians are not going to buy into this neural network thing because no one can explain them. We don't know how they work. Like, yes, they do stuff, but how can we make true scientific advances on something that we really don't deeply understand? And the truth is, I think that was some pretty good advice at the time. And he did draw out sort of limitations that we still struggle with, that the theoreticians, I think, still do take issue with the fact that we don't really know exactly. I mean, anyone that tells you, oh, I fully understand how this massive deep neural network works. Yeah, they're not really. And then on top of that, I think it was good advice too, because at the time, me trying to get a neural network job in the field would probably be very difficult. And so I stayed with parallel computing and joined Intel Labs in 2010. Now, at one point, I left Intel to join a startup, and I worked at the startup for about a year overseeing their engineering department. I'm sort of this one-off in that I have a very strong engineering background where I've done about 20 years of engineering, but I've also done about 15 years of research. And so I kind of have a foot in each of those things. And this startup found out about my engineering background, just oversee these cool new products that we're building. And I thought, yeah, this is a really interesting opportunity. And so I'm going to go do this. And so I left Intel, and Intel was sad about that. So they continued to ping me every month or so saying, Justin, will you come back? And I said, well, I'm having a lot of fun over here. You know, I love you guys. You're great people, great folks, but I want to explore this. And then they continued to come back and sort of like the offer and the things they were going to let me do continue to expand. About a year after this is going on, I start really paying attention to machine learning because I'm seeing all of these startups happen and I'm watching all this stuff with computer vision and natural language. This was around 2015. And I think to myself, you know, I've always wanted to do this. And Intel is now at the point saying, Justin, you can come back and we don't even care what you work on. We'll give you complete autonomy that we trust you. You've demonstrated, you have this really strong track record of producing stuff. Just come back and produce in any way you want. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to do that. So they convinced me to come back. I rejoined in 2016. And then I started to deeply look at machine learning. And in my exploration of machine learning, I started working with some of these brilliant people. And one of them is Armando Solar Lezama out of MIT. So I think this was around 2017 or something. I flew out to MIT and I had a couple conversations with a few MIT professors and grad students. And when I was flying back, I remember there was this distinct moment. I almost wish Rich Ulig was on this call because he can confirm that this is exactly how this happened. I was sitting on the airplane and I was just thinking about the conversations that we had. And I'm just in my head, not paying attention to anything that's going on in the plane. The plane could have been going down and I would be like, okay, whatever. And so I'm thinking so deeply about this idea. I have this moment of clarity where I realize I think we can use machine learning and other techniques for programming. And at that point, most people were thinking about machine learning just for things like computer vision or natural language processing. So I drafted up this email to Rich Ulig and put the red exclamation point on it and said, Rich, I have this idea and you and I have worked together for 7 years. I need you to trust me that this idea is going to be disruptive. And I think most people haven't figured this out yet, but they're going to. This could give us this competitive advantage. We need to start doing this now. And I had this like 3-page email drafted, which is, you know, not usually something you send to the head of Intel Labs, right? Usually wants these small bite-sized chunks. So I sent in this email and the response to me was basically like, I'm convinced, let's do it. And the rest, I guess, is history. That from 2017 forward, we've been nonstop, full steam ahead, doing everything we can in the space of machine programming.
I love it. Now, Justin, what's your vision of how this could eventually enhance developer productivity? Let's talk about that. What might be possible using this kind of technology for your average software developer?
This is a super great question. There's, I think, many different ways to answer it. But before I answer that question, I want to kind of maybe just tweak the question just slightly, but I will answer that question. Is one of the driving factors for machine programming with me is, according to the data that we have, there's approximately 27 million programmers in the world today. But we have a global population that's approximately like 7.8 billion people. And that means if you do the math, approximately 0.3% of the global population can code. There was this famous Wall Street Journal article that came out, I think 2004 or somewhere around there, saying something like, why software is eating the world. And the point of that article, as I understood it, is all about how software is everywhere now. That no matter what discipline, domain you're in, you're going to work with software in some ways. And even spaces that don't even, you would think they're so far away from software and they're still like agriculture. Oh, no, there's tons of software about agriculture and farming and things that just you'd think they'd be in that space. And so one of the things that bothers me so much and why I'm so passionate about machine programming is I really want to enable the global population the ability to create software. And the analogy that I kind of draw to when I explain this is sort of the equivalent of literacy, that if you are an illiterate person, it prevents you in so many ways not only in the fact that you aren't able to read and learn new things through written language, which is a tremendous disadvantage, but also that you may not be able to share your ideas, your brilliance in written form. And that piece is, I think, a direct parallel to software. Is I would like to see the other 99.7% of the global population the ability to create software. And one of the things that we're talking about developer productivity is not only do I want current developers to be more productive, I want to widen that funnel so every person in the world is a software creator. I don't even know what we call them anymore, because calling them coders doesn't seem right, because I think that they won't necessarily be writing code. And a good example of that is GitHub Copilot. You can basically write a comment in the form of natural language, and then it will try to synthesize the function that essentially fulfills the intention of that natural language. So now going back to your original question about productivity, I think that there's a number of things that we can do. If you look at the data, there's a study that came out from University of Cambridge in 2017 that broke down the costs of software development. And the conclusion that that study came to is basically 50% of all development time is spent in debugging, not ideation, not writing new code. And as someone who codes quite a bit, right, I created my first startup when I was 25, and I wrote about 500,000 lines of code. I can tell you from my personal view, debugging is one of my least favorite things in the world, right? And I really like pain, right? I seek out pain all the time. I was telling my girlfriend, like, part of the reason why I'm so crazy about exercise is it's suffering. And I feel like when I'm suffering, I'm growing. But debugging doesn't feel like growth to me in many cases. It feels like, oh my gosh, I've seen this before. How did I make this mistake again and again? Can someone just do the debugging for me? So a lot of the emphasis that we have in NPR and across Intel are building tools to help developers with their debugging. That the system, for example, Control Flag that we just open sourced is what we call an anomaly code detection tool. And code anomalies are essentially idiosyncratic patterns that are irregular, that they don't match the normal signature that one would expect to see. And it turns out that this system can identify some really fascinating anomalies. And in many cases, those anomalies are defects. And we don't know the exact number, but there was some report that came out that said something like 50% of the time that people spend debugging is actually trying to identify the bug. And then 50% is spent trying to then root cause it and then mitigate it, something to that effect. So if we can automatically identify some of these bugs for programmers, we're essentially effectively, in this sort of generalized way, helping bring down debugging by potentially 50%. Which we think is fantastic. And that's part of the reason why we open sourced it, is we want developers to be as productive as possible. And again, I think as I've seen, most programmers don't like debugging. And I think that when you understand machine programming is not meant to replace you, it's just meant to enhance you, then suddenly it becomes this sort of blessing that, wow, I have this supercharged assistant that's looking over and helping me correct stuff before it ever even goes into production. So that's a big focus of what we're doing right now. We're working on a bunch of other things, but one of the primary areas that we're working are in the space of automated debugging and automated performance extraction.
So you guys worked on the development of MISM in collaboration with MIT and Georgia Tech. So tell me, how are these tools different and what problems do you see them really addressing?
So first of all, this is a fascinating question, Amelia. And if you can believe it, the keynote address I just gave at ETH Zurich, this very question came up. Is
fantastic.
How do these two things fit together? Like what's the synthesis here? And the answer actually is, I think, really exciting. And we don't quite know yet if this is going to work, but we have a sneaking suspicion that it will at least drive some new ideas forward and hopefully gain at least a little bit of forward progress in this area that there's been very little progress. And that area is the detection of semantic bugs. In some sense, one might think of defects in software in two classes. And there's probably many different ways to think about defects. You know, they could be a correctness bug, could be a performance bug, a security bug, that kind of thing. But this is just one way to think about it. And that way is that there are bugs that are syntactical defects. And so the code will still compile, but it won't be exactly what you wanted it to be. So for example, you might say if X equals Y, when what you really meant to say is if X is equal to Y. And the C and C++ programming language, both of those are valid expressions, but the programmer usually means that second one. So that's an example of like a syntax bug. Some people would also argue it's a semantic bug, but the distinction I draw here is when I think about semantic bugs, I usually think of bugs that are multi-lined bugs that have to do with semantic analyzers, and that a semantic analyzer for machine programming are things that generally can look at code, lift out the semantic meaning, and then understand if the semantics match what they think the programmer is intending. So this is actually very similar to what verified lifting does. So verified lifting, it takes code in that Adobe case in C and C++, it lifts out that code to a higher order representation. It's a lambda calculus, which is basically a Turing complete type of representation in the form of a domain specific language. Right now, it has to be handcrafted for each problem domain. So every time they move to a different, they're going to do this for Gmail or do this for these other things. You have to create this new higher order DSL, allows us to capture the right kind of semantics, that type of thing. But with MISSUM is a code semantic similarity system. Part of the reason why we're so excited about MISSUM, I think part of the reason why MISSUM has received so much attention is its ability to look at code and say, these things are semantically equivalent. And it can do it even when the actual syntax varies significantly. For example, you might have a function that is performing a sort. And there's many ways to implement a sort function. One of them is like bubble sort. And another one is like quick sort. And MISSUM is able to look at things like this bubble sort and this quick sort, and then lift out the semantic meaning, send it through its system and say, I think that these two functions actually are semantically equivalent. Okay, now why is that helpful for control flag? Well, if we can add semantic analyzers to control flag such that control flag can only understand syntactical presentations, but understand semantics, then what it might be able to do is when we see anomalies, it could potentially look at the broader picture of the function that ProFlag can already find in these anomalous cases, lift out the semantic meaning, and then potentially try to find another matching piece that has near semantic equivalence. Maybe that's a golden copy that says, we know that this piece of code, this sort over here that we already wrote, is correct. And we know that you're trying to do a sort over here, but we found an anomaly in it. Now MISSUM can say, okay, I see that these are semantically similar, but they are not equivalent. This one's only 97% equivalent to this other one. And here are the pieces that it's different. Then we can report that back to control flag system, and then control flag will likely be able to detect these semantic bugs because it can then say, okay, MISSUM looked at this, said that they're 97% semantically equivalent. Here are the differences in the syntax that we think might be related to the defect, the anomaly that we found. And now suddenly, rather than just detecting what it does right now, maybe just these control expressions, it can in the future say, look, I've analyzed this whole function and here's what I think. I think you have an anomaly on this line. And I think the reason why this is an anomaly, because what you're trying to do is this operation, but you miswrote this piece of code on line 5. And then that's causing this anomalous code to show up in line 19. So what you need to do is you need to change line 5. And then the byproduct is it'll automatically fix the anomaly that we found on line 19. So that's one way that we are potentially looking to use MISSUM.
That is really cool, Justin. Now, as you continue your work in this domain, what are some of the more stubborn problems that you're trying to crack? And where do you see these big breakthroughs happening in this field, saying, in the next 2 to 3 years.
Oh no, I'm bounded to 2 to 3 years. Dang it. Okay. All right. This is a fantastic question. Okay. Some of the major challenges that I think that are, you know, obstacles that we need to overcome, I think, to make really important progress. The first is we have an abundance of code out there, and GitHub has done wonders for us in our ability to do things like control flag. The truth is, control flag simply would not exist if GitHub didn't exist, because what we do is we stare at GitHub repositories, 6,000 of them, process over a billion lines of code that's open source code that the community has given, you know, free access to, which is wonderful. We love the open source community. This is also part of the reason why we made control flag open source, is that we feel that if they're doing this for the community and we're building a system that's using their stuff, well, we should give our stuff back to the community to help them. It seems pretty fair. But the issue, one of the core challenges, is most of that code out there is not labeled. And not only is it not labeled, one of the challenges in semantic analysis or semantic analyzers that are going to do things like code semantic similarity is they tend to need labels. So for example, that sort example I was just talking about, we need to know that they're both sorts first, and then MISM can be trained on them. And then it says, okay, I know what a sort is now. But if those labels aren't there, then it's like, what am I learning here? Missing labels is extremely important. I just gave a talk actually at Snorkel AI, this future of data-centric AI. And one of the things that Snorkel is doing, you know, big shout out to Alex Radner and Chris Ray and all of them for launching this company, is they're building the system, they call it a weak supervision. And what weakly supervised systems do is they tend to only require a small amount of your data set to be labeled. And then through advanced techniques, it can try to generate the labels for the other like 90% of your data set that isn't labeled. Well, that's fantastic. And I've been in touch with Snorkel, and in my talk at Snorkel, I said, I'm begging you, I've been begging for the last 2 years for you guys to build Snorkel for machine programming, because they have all this code. In fact, I joke with Alex Radner and tell him that it's his fault that control flag got invented, because he wasn't giving me labels on data. So I had to invent control flag. So I blame him. If he would have given me my darn labels, I wouldn't have had to figure out control flag. And control flag is self-supervised, so it doesn't use any labels. It doesn't. We figured out something, I think, a little exciting in how you can process data in the machine programming space and not need any labels. So that's one of the biggest problems, is how do we make forward progress with a whole slew of data that's not labeled? And I think Jan LeCun just got this right. I think he mentioned this a few years ago, saying, I think self-supervision is going to be one of the most important areas moving forward in machine learning. And, you know, he just won the Turing Award with his colleagues for his contributions in the space of deep neural networks. So he's someone that I think is very knowledgeable about this space. And in listening to him and thinking about his ideas on self-supervision and then thinking about the lack of labels, this is what led us to build control flag. But the truth is, many of our other systems, in fact, I think almost all of the other systems require labels. So MISM does, and AutoPerf does, and various other ones do. So that, I would say, that's problem number one. The next biggest problem, I think, and if we crack this second one, I think the space of machine programming is going to explode. And the core challenge is to build highly reliable semantic analyzers. And the reason why I think this is so important is if we think about the way code has traditionally been sort of taken from a human and then brought down to the level where the machine can execute it using compilers, right, and other things. One of the core limitations of compilers has been they are principally syntactically bound. And when you are syntactically bound, it tends to mean you can't do larger things like algorithmic rewrites. So for example, if I write the sort, the bubble sort, but I know that that has a computational complexity of n squared. And if I knew that that was a bubble sort, then I would just write the quick sort, which has like n log n of computational complexity. It's just faster. It does the same thing. It's just a better algorithm. But because they're syntax bound, they don't understand the semantic meaning of the code. They can't do that optimization. So one of the big things that I think is an untapped area is traditionally compilers take code and lower it and lower it and lower it until it gets down to machine code. I think actually the future is the opposite. We will take code and we will lift it. We will go upwards. We will elide away system level details, all of these other artifacts that are specific to various ecosystems. And what will remain is just the semantics of the code. And then we can rewrite the entire system any way we want. We can make it automatically parallelizable. We can make it automatically distributed. We can write it so we know that it's secure. We know that it's correct. We can optimize it for like 100 different hardware backends. Essentially, the possibilities are endless. This is why we built MISM, is we thought, semantic analysis, semantic analyzers, this is the future. Once we get this right, we'll just rewrite everything. And so in summary, there's several others I could mention, but I'll just look at those two are the lack of labels on data and then advances in code semantic analyzers.
Excellent. Wow, Justin, this has been super cool. But before you go, it's time for your off-the-cuff question. Justin, if you could have one meal right now, it doesn't matter if the restaurant is closed, you need a passport to get there, it's on the other side of your state, what would you have?
Wow. Okay. I can't even remember the name of the restaurant, but I was visiting Boston and I was raised in New Jersey doing crab hunting with my uncle and my father. So I'm a big seafood fan. And I found this restaurant in Boston that had these lobsters that were just the best ever. I think it was so good. I got one, I ate it there, and I said, can I get another? Because I'm going to take this back to the hotel and I'm going to eat this. I don't care how much it costs. This is just so darn good.
Yeah.
So I think my answer would be that. I wish I could remember the name of the restaurant. Maybe I'll look it up and I'll send you an email afterwards.
But there you go.
That would be my missing dish.
Nice. Nice. Good choice, by the way.
Yeah. What about you? Just out of curiosity, Amelia, what about yourself? What would your missing dish be?
I would choose chili crab from Singapore.
Whoa.
I had chili crab on the quay in Singapore, and it was one of the most beautiful meals I've ever had in my life. So I would choose exactly that. Go to Singapore, sit next to the water, and have chili crab.
Wow. Yeah. I was keeping it domestic. I like how chili crab. Is that right?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to write this down. And the next time I'm in Singapore.
Excellent. Well, Justin, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, thank you, Amelia. Anytime. Thank you so much for the invitation. And hopefully we'll get to do this again sometime.
And before we go, don't forget to check out my new maker-themed monthly Fish Fry podcast series called Makers Today. In our fifth episode of this series, I chat with Guido Benelli from Dr. Duino. Guido and I chat about how art and electronic design intertwine in his life, how the Dr. Duino brand got started with a little help from Kickstarter, what his creation, the Goonie Box, is all about, and how the COVID-19 pandemic inspired him to create the Social Distancing Arduino Project. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And don't forget, if you want to follow my personal Twitter account, check out AmeliaD1978. And hey, if LinkedIn is your thing, sure, I dig it. You can follow us or me on LinkedIn as well. And we have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/EEJournal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series hosted by me. And you can subscribe to our EE Journal YouTube channel as well. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can subscribe to this here podcast through Spotify, Podbean, or Apple Podcasts. And remember, if you'd like to further support this podcast, please leave me a review on that podcasting platform of your choice. It really does help. Also, if you'd like any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Frying page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology or heck you just want to chat, shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of November 12th, 2021, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.